This week, Joshua chapter 9, in which the Gibeonites deceive Israel. We've been discussing Joshua's conquest of the Promised Land, but this week, Israel will stop fighting for a moment to make peace with some people who appear to be travelers from far off. It is not a good decision, as we will see, but it will give us an interesting ethical conundrum to consider. What comes first in Israel's list of priorities? Is it honoring their commitments or conquering the land? Your passage for consideration, then, is Joshua chapter 9, and if you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. First things first, what is a Gibeonite? The Gibeonites were ancient inhabitants of four cities in Israel's central mountainous region, the very region which Joshua and his army are strategically conquering. Those four cities, as our passage describes, were Gibeon, Kiriath-Jearim, Kephirah, and Beeroth. And by the name Gibeonite, we take it that Gibeon was chief among them. The city of Gibeon is today called Al-Jib. It is part of what eventually became the territory of Benjamin, and it sits not far northeast of Jerusalem. Al-Jib was excavated in the 1950s and 60s, and, confirming the biblical account, it was shown to be a city of mixed Canaanite and Israelite culture. Today's passage tells us that the residents of the area were Hivites. In addition to that, we have 2 Samuel 21 describing them as Amorites. But fear not, this is no contradiction. Looking back at the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, we see that the Amorites and the Hivites were both descendants of Canaan, the son of Ham. Their exact relationship to each other is not mentioned, but being close in proximity and culture and relation, they likely intermingled. So the people of Gibeon could be a mixed breed, or a mixture of two ethnic groups working together in one area. But whoever they were, the Gibeonites had a big problem. Israel was coming, and not just coming, but conquering. And not just conquering, but conquering ruthlessly, leaving none alive. The Gibeonites were smart enough to realize that with their neighbor A fallen, they could not resist the invading Israelite horde. They were smarter than the rest of Canaan. Per verses 1 and 2, the rest of Canaan banded together to fight back against Israel. They should have known it was futile. Israel had God on their side. But the Gibeonites decided that they would not save themselves through strength, but rather by subterfuge, and thus they hoped to save themselves by convincing Israel to make a peace treaty. Under normal circumstances, this would have been impossible. Israel had been commanded to take the land without offering any terms of peace to anyone. All of the Canaanites were to be destroyed. So the Gibeonites hatched a plan to deceive Israel into believing that they were not Canaanites at all, but travelers from a far-off country. File that one away as a scheme just crazy enough to work. In verses 4 through 6, we see how they enacted this plan. The Gibeonites decked themselves out with worn-out everything, so that they would look like they had been traveling for weeks or maybe even months. They wore worn-out clothes and sandals and carried worn-out sacks and wineskins. And they even carried stale, dried-out, crumbly food. And then they asked the Israelites to make a covenant with them. And it is amazing to me that this plan worked, because immediately the Israelites seemed suspicious. In verses 7 and 8, they explicitly ask where the Gibeonites came from, on the grounds that a peace covenant could not be made with them because they might live in the land. It seems that Israel desired to do the right thing here. They knew what God had commanded, and they act like they're planning to carry it out. And clearly they were wary so that they would not be deceived. And yet they still fell for it. In verses 12 through 13, the Gibeonites show off all of their worn-out provisions to prove that they came from a long way off. And their story was that they had been sent from their home country to make a treaty with Israel because they had heard of all that Israel's God had done previously in Egypt. We covered all of that back in the fall of 2017. And of what he had done to the kings of the east of the Jordan, which we discussed in our message Battle for East Jordan, published May 4th, 2019. And in verse 14, Joshua took the bait. He and the leaders of the congregation swore not to kill the Gibeonites. And like I said previously, I'm shocked that they fell for such a simple ruse. Of course, this makes a little more sense when we consider verse 14, which says that the men of Israel took the Gibeonite provisions and did not seek counsel of Jehovah. And that's a little frustrating for me, because I thought Israel had resolved that problem 2 chapters ago. 2 weeks ago, in a message titled Battle of A, Part 1, Achan's Sin and Joshua's Prayer, we discussed Israel's loss at A as a result, at least in part, of their failure to seek Jehovah's guidance. And yet, here we find that they made the same mistake twice. so I won't belabor the point since we've only recently discussed it, but it is better for you to ask God for guidance first and shoot later than to shoot first and ask God for guidance later. Then again, depending on how we take verse 14, we might take it that the leaders of Israel had a reason not to ask too many questions. We read there that the men took some of their provisions. Now, we might take that to mean that the Israelites took some of their crumbly bread so that they could examine it as evidence that the men had made a long journey. Or alternatively, we might understand this verse as telling us that some of the leaders were accepting provisions given to them from the Gibeonites in such a way that they were profiting off of the deal. Perhaps these Gibeonites were not only dressed in the guise of worn-out clothes, but were also carrying some valuable things that Israel's soldiers could put to use. The leaders may have looked at allowing the Gibeonites to live on the one hand, and leaving their army with less than ample provisions on the other, and decided to choose what they considered to be the lesser of two evils. Maybe a little bribe was enough to cause them to sweep their concerns about the Gibeonite deception aside, and to claim plausible deniability, that is, to set their own responsibility in the matter away, by claiming that they did not know. But whatever the reason, Israel made a foolish decision, and they ratified it to the highest standard, in the name of Jehovah himself. It was 3 days later that Israel heard, probably from their scouts, that these Gibeonites were in fact close neighbors, and evidently it was 3 days after that that some contingent arrived in the area of the four cities, some 10 to 15 miles southwest of Ai. Now, if it had been me, I might have tried to wiggle out of the commitment at this point. I might have argued that the agreement with Gibeon was null, because it was made under deceptive terms, not with the people of Gibeon, but with a non-existent nation from an imaginary far-off place. Or I might have argued that oaths of peace made with Canaanites were forbidden, and thereby also null. But the leaders of Israel viewed it differently. They did not attack Gibeon because they had sworn an oath in Jehovah's name and were going to stick with it. And the whole issue, I think, boils down to a thorny ethical question. If God tells you to do one thing, and you have sworn in his name to do another mutually exclusive thing, what do you do? And I'm not sure that we have an answer in this passage. But we'll save the ethical considerations for after we finish the narrative. In verse 18, we read that the decision to uphold the oath to Gibeon was an unpopular one. The people, eager to fulfill the command of conquest, grumbled against their leaders when they heard that they would not be attacking Gibeon. But the leaders made an attempt to change their mind by explaining their reasoning, that violating an oath made in Jehovah's name would bring wrath down upon them, and apparently this appeased the people. This, however, does not mean that there were no consequences for the Gibeonites. Joshua called them to be questioned, and he gave them a firm tongue-lashing, and he penalized them by making them slaves. We see in verse 18 that the Gibeonites became woodcutters and water carriers for the entire congregation. They did the miserable, laborious jobs that no one wanted. And Joshua took some of them and gave them as slaves to serve the tabernacle specifically. As for the Gibeonites, they willingly submitted to this treatment. They accepted it as a grace, knowing that the alternative was death, and that many of the people wanted to give them that alternative. And here we must take a moment to turn our attention to the Hebrew word, Nathan. The word means to give, and thus our English name Nathan describes a child as a gift from God. The word is used in Joshua 9:27, where it says that Joshua gave them to be choppers of wood. Your English translation probably says made them to be, as if he had changed their status by making them wood choppers. The Hebrew sees it a little bit differently. They were given as workers for the task, as property. It's a subtle distinction, to be sure. But the word Nathan matters because it becomes the root for the word Nathanim, that is, the given people. This word is used later throughout the scriptures and is often translated as temple servants or some such. You see this particularly in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Rabbinical tradition holds that these temple servants were descended from the same original Gibeonites and that they retained this position generation after generation. They did not remain purely Gibeonite, however. Ezra 8:20 records, for instance, that David had added some additional captured slaves into the mix. There is no mention of the Nathanim in the New Testament, and it is supposed that during the intertestamental period, when Israel was under the rule of the Greeks and Romans, the Nathanim finally merged into the general population of Israel. So then, that wraps up the passage. Let's turn our attention then to the ethical question. If God told Israel to do one thing, to destroy all of the Canaanites, and also told them to keep oaths made in his name, is it right for them to keep an oath to disobey the former command? In this case, Israel had orders to destroy the Canaanites, but had sworn in Jehovah's name not to destroy them. So, what do they choose? And perhaps more importantly, why? Well, they chose to keep their word to Gibeon, and my supposition is that they could only have done so because of a principle of priority. They really had two commands from God here. The first was to destroy Canaan, but the other was to never take Jehovah's name in vain. To swear this oath and then not keep it would be a vain usage of Jehovah's name. See our members only message, No False Oaths, published December 31st, 2017. So Israel must have determined that the latter command, the third of the Ten Commandments, took priority over the command to completely destroy Canaan. Is that the correct choice? Well, I don't know for certain, because the passage doesn't say. First, we should consider that this passage is descriptive, not prescriptive. A prescriptive passage is one which gives us instructions on what should happen. It prescribes a course of action. A descriptive passage is one which gives us instruction on what did happen. It records history without making a judgment on it. The passage then doesn't say they were right to do it, but simply that they did do it. Now, in a very narrow sense, I think that they did make the correct decision. The command to honor Jehovah's name and our commitments is a transcendent one, applicable to everyone in every age. And not only that, but it is of primary significance. It is the third commandment, listed only after having no other gods and making no idols. The entire social structure depends on having Jehovah as its backing, and without reverence for his name, the social glue breaks down. And of course, we all need to be able to trust each other and our contracts. Meanwhile, the command to seize Canaan was temporal and of limited practical use. Getting rid of Canaan had no deep fundamental ethical purpose. Canaan was an immediate headache that needed to be cleaned up, but it wasn't worth overturning the entire apple cart. However, I think the answer might be different in a more broad case. If, for example, a person swore in God's name to enter a life of prostitution and never to leave it, this would be an assault on the character of God as expressed in sexually pure marriage. Sexual purity is also a transcendent principle, and all generations must observe it. So perhaps, just perhaps, such an oath would not be binding, while the oath to the Gibeonites was. Well, today's passage may not give us a clear indication of whether or not the decision at Gibeon was the right one, but as we continue to look through the scriptures, there is another passage which might shed some light on the topic. 2 Samuel 21, 1-14 relays the story. There, we read that in the time of King Saul, hundreds of years later, Saul zealously attempted to kill the Gibeonites. Evidently, this was an attempt to correct what he viewed as a historical failure on the part of Israel's leaders, in today's passage. However, we get the impression that God did not approve of Saul's action. After Saul left the throne, a famine came on the land, and Jehovah himself declared that it was a punishment on the land for Saul's error in killing the Gibeonites. That, of course, is not a direct statement of approval for what Israel's leaders did in the time of Joshua. Saul lived many years later and was dealing with an entirely different generation, perhaps even a generation which abhorred the sins of their fathers and had converted to the service of Jehovah. So maybe God disapproved of Saul's actions because God supported the decision made in the time of Joshua, or maybe he disapproved of Saul for wholly different reasons. Whatever the case, the famine ended when David put to death the sons of Saul, whom I expect had been involved in the killing of the Gibeonites. Explicitly, the passage tells us that God responded to prayers for the land after justice was done against Saul's sons. Whether the action taken today in sparing Gibeon was right or wrong, we note that this is one of many examples in which an oath in God's name is taken in a descriptive passage to have a very high priority. We saw an example of this way back in Genesis 25, when Jacob deceived his father Isaac to steal his brother's blessing. We discussed it on October 16th of 2016. His father, having sworn the matter, could not take it back. And we see it again in the tragic story of Jephthah from Judges 11, where Jephthah sacrifices his own daughter to fulfill a rash vow. We note, as previously, that this is not a prescription. We are not ordered to maintain all such vows. But we do have examples that such vows were held with the highest priority in these times, for better or worse. So all of the evidence concerning such cases is this. God's name is to be respected, and oaths made in his name matter. And it is for that reason that Jesus gave us additional guidance on the issue. He famously discussed oaths in his Sermon on the Mount, recorded in Matthew chapter 5. There he said, I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. So then it was Jesus' teaching that we ought not to take oaths at all, because taking oaths would put us into a situation in which we are stuck. Sometimes we're powerless to even fulfill the oath, and no ability to repay the penalty either. So, while the one true God is to be the backing of our commitments, we ought not to put ourselves into the same situation that Israel found themselves in with Gibeon. We ought to be prepared to commit, but we would only risk injuring ourselves by putting God's name on the line. And beyond that, there ought to be no reason to use God's name to back up our commitments, because we ought to be trustworthy enough that people believe our yes and our no in the first place. In conclusion, then, this is the story of the Gibeonite deception in which the people of Gibeon, fearing for their lives, fooled Israel, under Joshua's leadership, into making a covenant of peace with them, sworn in the name of Jehovah. It was an oath which Israel should not have made. They fell into the trap because they failed to consult Jehovah for guidance. But once the oath was made, they decided that it would be better to respect the name of God by keeping their word than it would be to conquer the Gibeonite cities. And while the scriptures do not explicitly endorse that decision, the evidence does weigh in its favor. As for the Gibeonites, they became water carriers and wood choppers, slaves doing the least desirable tasks, and some of them were appointed to serve generation after generation for the priests at the tabernacle. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.